Hello and welcome to Automators, the show where we talk things, all things smart tech, automation, and getting technology to do your work for you. I am Rosemary Richard, and I'm joined by my pal and co-host David Sparks. Hey, David, how are you?
I am great, Rose. I'm a little sad because this is our last episode of the Automators podcast, but I'm so happy to be here talking to you today.
Yes. I am going to miss the show a lot, as we have heard from many listeners that they will as well, which has been lovely to hear. But unfortunately, it is one of those things where this is what we need to do. And so that's what we're going to do. But that doesn't mean we're not going to try and deliver a great show for everybody.
Yeah. You know, and for those who missed out for any reason, Rose and I both are just incredibly busy and we had to make some tough decisions. This show takes a lot of work to make it right, and it ended up something that we decided to retire, sort of. I mean, the more I think about it, we're sort of retiring it, because that doesn't mean that Rosemary Orchard isn't going to be guesting on Mac Power Users once in a while, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean MPU is going to be talking about automation more now that, you know, this platform won't be here. So definitely follow over at MPU and keep an eye on the show titles if you're not interested in everything we do, but keep an eye for the automation related titles, and Rose will be guesting. And I think we're going to be able to get a lot of automation coverage, just not as much as we were doing with a twice monthly show. But I've never shut down a podcast before, so this is a very strange experience. I woke up this morning just feeling kind of glum about it, but at the same time, I know it's what we need to do. And it was kind of something both of us are going through right now. We just need a little more time to make the other stuff we're working on as good as possible. And that's, you know, that's life.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we always want to give people the best possible podcast. So, you know, if we can't deliver that, then we will, you know, be selling ourselves short, as well as all of our fabulous listeners like you. So, yeah, we had to do the right thing, but we really wanted to do the right thing.
Yes. So I thought for today's final episode, we've got some big picture automation questions to talk about and answer, but got a bunch of great feedback. And on the Automators Max, the ad for extended version show, we're going to talk about where we see the future of Apple intelligence and automation kind of, you know, coming together. So we've got a lot of good stuff to talk about today. I guess we should just get started with the big question, Rose. Why do you automate?
Oh, this is a challenging one, David, because, you know, there's a number of reasons. Like, a lot of the time I will start by creating a little automation for a thing because there's multiple steps to it. And I just need to get those steps right. I have to do them in the right order. And, you know, I can't miss a step. You know, if you miss step six, then everything sort of goes haywire and wrong. So that's a lot of the time where I start with, you know, it's about the accuracy of the thing that I'm doing versus the speed in particular. But sometimes it's also, I know I can do this task manually right now, but actually it's faster for me to write a quick script. And I'm using script as a generic term. It could be a shortcut, could be a keyboard maestro macro, could be a script, but some kind of automation solution to just do the thing, because I need to, you know, take 20 lines from here and combine them with 20 lines over there to create 400 results. So, you know, it's a little bit easier to do that sometimes. What about you?
Well, I think you hit the big points there, but I think the first one is just friction, right? There's a lot of stuff that we encounter, particularly with the digital devices in our lives, where in an effort to make it accessible to everyone, they made it tedious for power users. You know, like, you've got to go through and push this button and then push that button. And all of that makes sense for a lot of people who don't do this stuff very often, aren't particularly tech literate, and you just want to make sure they've got the ability to use the technology in a way that benefits them. But all of that adds extra friction. And there's an underlying part of me that absolutely hates that friction. Like, if I have to put something in and then do one extra step, every time I do it, it makes me nuts. And I think that's been true for me since I first started using computers. Back in the old Tandy color computer, too, I was looking for ways to automate things. I think I remember I wrote a script about when you plugged in the cassette recorder, you know, for saving files. And there was just stuff I was doing back in the original hardware. And so my whole life, I've always been bugged by that. And I think a lot of people listening to the show have that same affliction. And it feels really good to fix that. Like when you have an automation, whether, you know, you're creating a project list in OmniFocus, or you do some little bit of magic with shortcuts or something more expansive that does like some of the cool stuff Rose does in the behind the scenes on our show. Every time you see it work efficiently, there's a part of me that releases happy chemicals. I don't know how else to put it, you know? So that's, I think, the big reason for me is the elimination of friction. The side benefit, of course, is when you automate, it's consistent, you know? Not only does it mean that you don't have to do it, it means that you won't get it wrong. Like a great example for me with that is mail sorting. Like I know all these people who sort their mail into folders and they sit there and they drag it into folders and like manually, it takes a ton of time to do that. And there's so many great automation tools, whether it's server side or client side, or, you know, there's just so many ways to sort that mail faster. Mm-hmm. And when you put it in automation, it always puts it in the right folder. I mean, you know, it always gets it right. When you do it with your mouse, if you're not paying close attention, occasionally you're going to get in the wrong place and you won't be able to find it. And, you know, that's a good example where automation is consistent. So it's faster, eliminates friction, and it's consistent. And yeah. I think that's just a great goal when you're using computers to be able to do that kind of thing. And to do it yourself. I mean, I think the other thing about automation is we've got to a point where anybody can do it. You know, that was the big goal of this show, frankly, was that not necessarily just the, you know, high-end computer programmer types, but people who are dentists or students or people who have very little automation experience could listen to an episode and pick up something and turn it into an automation thing, which I think leads to the next point. And I know I'm kind of rambling here, but it's fun. It's fun to automate.
Yeah.
It's fun to do this stuff and hook it all up and make it work.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, that is, you know, part of the satisfaction. You know, if I just had, you know, 20 records here, 20 records there, and I need to create a combination where, you know, all of the first 20 records can be combined with all the second 20 records, you know, like I can do that with a spreadsheet, or I can just copy and paste things or whatever it is. But creating a little automation for it, you know, it satisfies that little itch in my brain that wants to solve problems in a fun way, because that sort of problem solving for me is fun. And even if that bit's not fun, there is always a sense of satisfaction for a lot of things in knowing that you've done the job right. And that is the other part of what I really love about automation. You know, I've created this project in OmniFocus and I've got the folder over here and I've got a document here that I can take notes into right away for this. And I can see, you know, my task list over there. All of those things, because I pressed a button and typed a number. And then next time I would sit down to record an episode of Automators, the same thing would happen. It would pop up and say, hey, what's the next episode of Automators? By the way, I already added one because you know, I'm smart enough to remember it. Create the folder, open OmniFocus to show me what I need to know, add some tasks for the next episode, and so on and so forth. And then I can see all of the things that I need to do, and it just works. And then when I finish, you know, the files automatically get renamed and dropped into the folder that Jim needs access to, our wonderful editor, and everything just magically happens. And knowing that I don't have to sit there and manually do 20 things to make this happen is great. You know, does it save time? Yes. Yes, it does save time. But it's also just, I got the job done. I got the job done right. And it didn't matter how turned on my brain was when I pressed the button and how much of a tiz I was in because I was running late from this or that or whatever it was. The thing happened because I clicked the button and that was all I needed to do. And then it ran off and it did the magic. And I think that for me is the most magical part.
Yeah. Another great thing about automation is that the knowledge is cumulative. So as you learn automation, it just adds on to itself. If you start out just making like a two-step shortcut, before you know it, you're making four-step shortcuts. And then before you know it, then you're combining it with a keyboard maestro script. And then suddenly you find yourself writing Apple script. You know, just the knowledge accumulates. And once you have, you know, I always use the analogy of a tool belt, you know, once you start learning the different tools, so you've got the hammer and the screwdriver and the pliers, you'd be surprised what all you can do with automation, because you've got the knowledge of these various tools and how to use them together. And so it's very satisfying in that way, that the knowledge, you know, it's not like you have to start from reinvention of the wheel with every time you automate something. Like every time you do another thing, you can use a little bit of the knowledge you learned the last time you did something like that.
Absolutely.
There's another piece of this, though, and I don't think we've ever really addressed this question on this show, but I think it's important to discuss here, especially at the end, is what automation can't do for you. And the thing that brings this up in my mind is, you know, I hear from people, especially with the emergence of ChatGPT and large language models, looking for automation to go like a step further. Like I talked about this in the OmniFocus field guide, which led to some emails from folks that were like throwing all their tasks at artificial intelligence, saying, okay, look at all these tasks I've written down and decide which ones I should do today. And people also do that with calendaring now. And there's apps out there specializing in figuring out what should you calendar today and what should you do today. I personally feel like automation is great for the mechanical bits, but it's not good for the decision bits. And maybe this is just, we're too early in the process, and that someday in the future, AI will get so good that I'll change my mind on it. But I feel like there's parts of this stuff where we as humans need to take an active role, and automation really isn't the answer.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things where, you know, you can use automation to give you a serious, you know, head start on some of these things. Like, for example, creating a packing list for a trip, right? You could ask ChatGPT or Claude or any of these AIs to create a packing list for a trip from, and you'll be traveling to this particular location on these dates. And so it can do things like look up what the average weather patterns, it can count how many days there are. It might not be able to count how many hours are in Strawberry, but it can try and count how many days there are in your trip, and therefore it will suggest things like 5 pairs of underwear because you know you're gone for 5 days, things like that. And that's great, but it's only suggesting things based on its knowledge. And I think what is really easy to forget is we have a lot of contextual awareness of things that we are not ourselves aware of. So if I were to ask it to organize, you know, I gave the testers at work today a couple of new things to get started on. And that means that there's 2 testers looking at 2 different things that I've created. And both of them are saying like, hey, I found like this little bit that doesn't look quite right. That little bit doesn't look quite right. There's a typo here, so on and so forth. Absolutely fine. I could ask it to you know, organize handling all of those and tell me which bug do I work on first. Cool. But it doesn't know that one of those projects has potentially a lot more associated issues with it than the other, and so on and so forth. So I would have to give it that information. And it doesn't necessarily know by looking at the titles that actually these 2 things, they're linked. And I can see that because I can look at it and I know that they're linked. And if I'm going to have to do all that information to deliver that context into an AI bot, by the time I've done that, I can have also just had a look at the 5 different things that I've been asked to look at and decided I'm going to do this one first because it's probably going to do that one as well. And then I'm going to tackle those 3 in whatever order appeals to me most in the moment, because it depends on how the first couple go. And I think, you know, it's one of these things where we still need the checks and balances of ourselves in there. You can't just turn your brain off after you've asked ChatGPT to create a packing list for Berlin, because otherwise it'll tell you to pack 5 pairs of underwear. You pack 5 pairs of underwear and you don't realize it was including socks as underwear. Are socks a separate packing list item? Yes or no? Well, that depends on you and your context, but if you end up on holiday somewhere and you don't have socks, you can try and blame ChatGPT, but at the end of the day, you're the one that put it in the suitcase. So we still have to take some responsibility for these things. And, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the, it seems like it's a really powerful tool, and it absolutely is, but it's not perfect. None of these things are. And we always need to, you know, double check these things ourselves and make sure that we've actually got a good result that we can work with, or don't see what is produced by an AI as a result, see it as a stepping stone to get to the final result. It just needs one of those final checks before you take it and pass go and collect your $200.
Yeah. I mean, one of the primary reasons I jump out of bed every day and make content for Max Barkey is because I feel like there's something I have to add. And I have always been an optimist about technology. I believe that it can make your life better. It can make you better at things you do. It can be truly a great assistant for us. There are elements of AI that I think one day will give us all so much help that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And I see that. But I also feel fundamentally that Silicon Valley has failed us. Like when we first saw computers when I was a kid and, you know, the Timex Sinclair and the Tandy color computers were first showing up, we all said, isn't this great? We're all going to be so much more productive and better at things when we can dump our typewriters and calculators and have a computer that does so much of this stuff for us. And what happened instead was a bunch of people in Silicon Valley realized they could make a lot of money by selling advertising. And a lot of what comes out of the technology sector is not meant to make your life better or make you better, but it's meant to turn you into a product so it can sell advertising. Mm-hmm. And but I do think if you're knowledgeable about that, if you go at this mindfully, that you can truly live the dream. You can make this technology work for you. You can make your life better using it. And automation absolutely fits in that. It's a big piece of the puzzle in my mind. But the danger, like Rose was saying, is if you go too far down the rabbit hole with this stuff and you start thinking you can automate the humanness part, well, you can't. And you shouldn't want to. So that's the trick. You got to find those limits. And I think the other one, and we've talked about this on the show, is be careful about automation rabbit holes. Don't, you know, if you're only going to do something once or twice, don't spend 2 days writing an automation for it. Just do it. And and everybody has to kind of make their own decision about the payoff for that. Rose and I tend to go down the rabbit hole pretty quickly, but we share it, you know, with the stuff we make and where we publish the shows and things. So other people benefit from it. But if you're just making it for yourself, be careful about that. But I think the bigger question, as we are at this kind of turning point with AI emerging, is, you know, think about the kinds of things you want to automate and do it thoughtfully. Just be careful. You know, I don't think it's ever going to pick what your best calendar items are. I think you need to pick that. You need to take ownership of that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, going back to what you said, David, about, you know, if you're only going to do this once or twice, you know, don't spend forever writing automations on it. You know, do consider how long is it going to take to do this task and then check that it was done correctly versus how long is it going to take to build the automation? Check the automation works correctly. And then run it, because sometimes it might take you 2 days to automate something you're only going to do once. But if that was going to take you 2 months to do it by hand, that's absolutely worth it. It takes you 2 days to automate a task that should have taken you 2 minutes. I mean, it's a good learning exercise, 100%, but it may not have been the best use of your time. And the other thing I'll just say, you know, relating to automation is, you know, ask, you know, AI for suggestions on how to automate things by all means, but never assume that any code that it gives you is correct. Like make an effort to try and understand what it's saying and learn the meaning of what it's actually done and check whether or not it's done it correctly. Because I have seen so much code spat out by various AIs that just straight up doesn't work or it doesn't do what you've requested it to. But unless you know how to code and the code that is produced, that's not necessarily obvious. I think we're kind of lucky with shortcuts in respect that we can't just write a script and that be the shortcut. I know you can with jelly cuts and some other things, actually write it as a script and then have it converted into a shortcut. But it's not quite the same thing. And ChatGPT is fortunately for us not there yet, because I can't imagine the fun and games it would have, you know, randomly creating shortcuts actions that just straight up don't exist, because that would be interesting, but not necessarily great for the person trying to do the automation.
This episode of The Automators is brought to you by Notion. Try the powerful, easy-to-use Notion AI today. Go to notion.com/automators. There's so much to love about Notion. I use Notion to run the back end of Mac Sparky, and it's such a great collaborative tool. The addition of Notion AI has made a huge difference. We put transcripts of everything I publish in there. We use it to flush out outlines for ideas. It's just really handy. Just yesterday, I used Notion AI to alter the formatting of some text I had written. All of this is available right in Notion with Notion AI. The new Notion AI is a single AI tool that does it all. You can search across Notion and other apps, generate docs in your style, analyze PDFs and images, and chat with you about anything. Notion is a perfect place to organize your tasks, track your habits, write beautiful docs, and collaborate with your team. And the more content you add to Notion, the more Notion AI can personalize its responses for you. Because unlike generic chatbots, Notion AI already has the context of your work. Notion AI is connected to multiple knowledge sources. It uses AI knowledge from GPT-4 and Claude to chat with you about any topic. It can search across thousands of Notion docs in seconds to quickly answer any question. And with AI connectors, now in beta, Notion AI can search across Slack discussions, Google Docs, Sheets and Slides, and more tools like GitHub and Jira are coming soon. Notion is used by over half of Fortune 500 companies, so you'll be in good company. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/automators. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/automators, to try the powerful, easy-to-use Notion AI today. And when you use our link, you're supporting our show. That link, once again, notion.com/automators, all lowercase. And our thanks to Notion for their support of the Automators and all of Relay FM. We got a lot of great feedback heading into the show today. The first one was a note from Peter. He said, I just wanted to say I understand your decision to wrap up the show. I wear too many hats myself, so I get being stretched too thin. However, I'll be sorry not to have the show in my rotation. I will share that you got me started on my journey with Home Assistant back with when Rosemary talked about it in 2021. I'm now all in with the platform, and I've learned so much along the way. And then he says some other nice things to us. I feel like Home Assistant was one of the big, you know, coverage points of this show throughout its run. And for good reason. It's like the home stuff, but so much better.
Yes, yes. And I mean, just to go back for anybody who's looked at it before and gone like, oh, it seems like it's quite big and so on, like, it absolutely can be big, but the purpose of Home Assistant is essentially to replace HomeKit, but that doesn't mean that you don't get HomeKit. The idea with Home Assistant, really big goal, put everything in Home Assistant and then share it back to HomeKit or to your Alexas or Google Home, or they've just announced they're working on, they announced at GitHub Universe, they've got a physical voice assistant box that you can buy now, which is really cool. That sort of, you know, thing is pretty awesome. But for me, the power of Home Assistant 100% is, okay, I was ambitious and I wrote a script to do a thing, or I wrote an automation to do a thing. And now at 3 o'clock in the morning, my lights turn on. Why? And the fact that I can just go into the logbook and see Rose did a silly. Why did Rose do a silly? Ah, well, this thing triggered at 3 o'clock in the morning and that shouldn't have happened. Okay, well, I can fix that. The fact that I can actually go back and figure out what I've done and what's happening and so on and so forth. So when things don't happen or do happen, I can actually see why. That is so powerful. And especially when you're, you know, first really getting started and diving in and creating all of these fancy automations, it's really nice to be able to see that sort of thing. You know, I need it less now. I make fewer mistakes, but every so often I get a little overambitious and write a really cool, complicated automation. And then I'm there going, why did the lights in my office turn on as soon as I woke up this morning? That's a question I need to solve. And I can, because I can see exactly why it happened, which is great.
Yeah, it took me a while to kind of adopt Home Assistant. And that's for a couple of reasons. As we've talked about on the show, I was really in deep with Home, Apple HomeKit, and the family had adopted it, and I didn't want to mess things up for them. But with Rose's encouragement, I've really kind of been diving deeper with Home Assistant, particularly in my workspace, because I have like a room that is kind of where I do all my work, and they don't need to have any HomeKit, you know, stuff there. So it gives me freedom to do more experimentation with it. But also I'll say over the last several years, the Home Assistant team has made this much less of a fringe technology. Like the user interface has got better. Just booting it up and starting using it is so much easier than it was even when I first started, that I think this is much more accessible to people than they probably think at this point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just one of those things where it's, you know, it's worth going and taking a look at it and seeing all of the sorts of things that you can add to your smart home that you can't necessarily do yet through HomeKit. You know, HomeKit is getting more powerful, especially with the Matter support that is coming, but Matter is a bit slow to roll out. You know, that's not a complaint against Matter. I'd much rather they took their time to do it right. But there's a lot of devices that don't necessarily get full integration with HomeKit that are already in Home Assistant, or just the ability to be like, hey, so I have a sensor on a door and I also have a heating system. And whenever the automation runs to control my heating system, I just want to check that the door's closed before I do that. And when the door opens, I want to turn off the heating and then I want to turn it all back on. And I just kind of like want it in one automation. I don't want six different automations to control the same sort of thing. And, you know, that being able to create the generic entities and devices and so on and so forth. You know, I've got a climate sensor, which checks the humidity, and I have a smart plug on my dehumidifier, and I've combined the two of them to create a smart dehumidifier that takes the excess moisture out of the air. You can do the same thing to create a smart humidifier. It's in fact the same integration. And the fact that I can just take two non-smart entities or two smart things and put it on a dumb one and make it smart, that to me is a real killer. You know, I don't have to go around replacing the expensive dehumidifier that I have. I can make it smart with a few cheaper things that I already have.
Yeah, I just, this is kind of unrelated, but I bought on Black Friday, I bought a couple Eufy door locks. And I've been using the ones that I could rekey. They were Kwikset, but they're kind of getting old in a tooth. And I had a couple doors that didn't have smart locks on them. And the Eufy had a sale on the one that is a smart lock, but it also has a camera in it. And at least for the front door, it's really nice to be able to have the camera pointed right out your front door. And so I went ahead and installed that. But of course, it doesn't work with HomeKit. And like that's one of my to-do items, is to get all that plugged in, because I'm sure that Eufy has a connection to Home Assistant, and I would be able to use Home Assistant to control those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ian says, I've really enjoyed your show for many years now, and I've learned so much from you. I know I'm much more efficient now with my Mac and my programming tasks and tools. The Stream Deck probably would not be on my desk without the Automators podcast. Well, you know, I think a lot of Stream Decks are on people's desks because of our show.
I think, David, by that you mean there's a lot of Stream Decks on your desk because of this show.
Well, yes.
And that,
yes,
that may have bled out to a few listeners here and there. But yeah, you've definitely got a few.
And Ian continues, sorry to see the show closing, but I understand that it's more burden than fun now. That isn't true. It's still fun. It's just, we're both very busy. So we're just trying to like get a little more management over our life.
Yes.
But the Stream Deck, yeah, that was another very common refrain in the show. I stumbled into the Stream Deck. I actually bought it when I was making the Keyboard Maestro Field Guide, and they had added Stream Deck support. And I said, you know, this is one of those things where I'm like, well, I'm not sure I need something like that. I'll get one and play with it and decide whether or not to include it in the field guide. And like within a few days, I was like, oh, this is the greatest. And and now I have a whole flock of them.
Yes, you have a family of Stream Decks now, which is pretty cool.
Although one of mine left me. My daughter took my Neo. She needed it for school, where she's a teacher, and she was doing a bunch of stuff at school that was very automation adjacent, so I set her up with it and taught her how to use it. So now it has flown out of the nest, but otherwise I still have a bunch of them.
Yeah, I mean, something I spotted recently as well, which I have not yet had a chance to purchase and play with, but Logitech have a Creative Hub, which looks very similar to a Stream Deck.
Yeah.
And I am really curious. It's called the Creative Console. I'll pop a link to it in the show notes. But you get two physical devices with it. So there's one which has a dial, like a rotary dial. And then at the top, it's got another sort of scrolly uppy down thing and a couple of buttons on it. And then on the other one, there are 9 screen buttons and also pagination buttons at the bottom going left and right. And I'm very curious about this. They say that there are plugins available, and I did look, and there is a Discord plugin and Photoshop plugins, you know, the Adobe Creative Suite. And I think there's a Philips Hue one in beta, but I'm not sure that there's anything beyond that, you know, for real kind of home automation-y stuff as well, which, you know, personally is what I would be looking at as a curiosity. But it still looks pretty cool. So
yeah.
I'm interested to see how this goes. I'm glad to see that somebody else is doing something that is so akin to the Stream Deck. Not saying that it needs direct competition, but it is nice to see an alternative to this with a productivity focus versus a streaming focus. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think that the idea of it is great, and competition is good. I was looking at that because I was thinking, man, that dial alone might be useful to me. I'm already kind of in enough with buttons, but the I don't think they sell it separately. I think you have to buy them as a pair.
No, you have to buy the pack of two together. And the thing that makes me pause in particular is it's £199. I believe it's $199.
That's a lot of money.
Which is not the cheapest. You know, I have not checked the price on the Stream Deck Studio recently, which is the Stream Deck that you mount into a rack, like a server rack, and it's got two physical dials on and a whole bunch of buttons in two rows. I've checked online. That one is $899. So that one is by far the most expensive. The Stream Deck XL, which has got 32 buttons on it, I think. Yeah, 48 to 32. That's $250, but that is 32 buttons versus 9 buttons. So yeah, it's not the cheapest. And until the marketplace gets a little bigger, I personally would hold off from buying it. But I wonder if this is going to be like the Windows Phone problem, chicken and the egg. There are no plugins because there are no users, and there are no users because there are no plugins.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm limited on desk space. I'm not putting something on my desk that I can't definitely use on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I'm pretty good on buttons right now. I do think the Stream Deck is really an interesting thing for automation, and that wasn't really made for that. But I know there are, you know, I guess maybe because we make the show, but I've heard from so many people that are using Stream Deck for exactly the kinds of things we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the dial pad in particular, part of the Logitech setup, uses AA batteries. Like this is something, because they have it listed under the specs and details. They've split them out into the two different things. They've got the MX Creative dial pad and the MX Creative keypad. And the dial pad uses two AAA batteries, and the keypad uses USB-C. I'm guessing because it requires more power than batteries can provide. But it's interesting that one is wireless and one is wired. It's an odd combination to me. But hey, I'm looking forward to seeing what Logitech do with it. And hopefully, fingers crossed, that marketplace will take off in the not too distant future.
Yeah. Another device that I tried over the run of the show that I don't think I actually talked about on the show because I didn't think it was appropriate was the Loop Deck. And the Loop Deck is like a really well-made looking Stream Deck, but it's very customized to video editing and photo editing. That's, I think, you know, mm-hmm. It's called the creative tool for a reason, but it's like made of metal. It's like, it's heavier. The buttons feel firmer. The dial is very weighted and nice. Just a really nice piece of kit, but it's like over $500, and it really isn't automation friendly. It except for if you're like working in Adobe Creative Suite or Final Cut or, you know, something like that. But yeah, there are other devices out there, but I feel like the Stream Deck really just scratches the itch for people who want to tie automation to a button that's not on their keyboard.
Yes. I think it's one of those things where it got in there early, and also the way that you can create a lot of the tools for it, you know, the plugins, a lot of it can be done with JavaScript, which is just a really widely known programming language. And even if you don't necessarily use, you know, standard vanilla JavaScript every day, it's not that difficult if you're familiar with the language to regress a little bit. I call it regress. It's not really, but to take a few steps back from the niceties of whatever framework it is that you're used to using and to just, you know, write some plain old JavaScript. And, you know, that's something that's pretty nice. So fingers crossed. However, I haven't checked how to write Logitech plugins for their creative keypad, but I should take a look at that just out of curiosity at some point.
Yeah, why not, right?
Yep. I mean, I'm going to be pretty busy, but maybe I'll find some time at some point.
Okay. Brian writes in saying that he's been enjoying listening to the show. He says, I do hope you can put together some resources for those of us who wish to continue learning more about automation on the Mac and iOS. I look forward to many good things from the two of you in the future. Well, like we said earlier, we're going to be doing some coverage of this on Mac Power Users, and Rose will be involved with that. We also have the, you know, the vault of automators episodes that you can get.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And so, you know, there's all of those automators episodes, including the automators Max ones. Those will not be going away. They're going to be sticking around on the Relay website. If I believe Mike and Steven have anything to say about it, they don't like getting rid of these things. So, you know, all those episodes are still going to be there. And yes, of course, we've done some episodes covering particular things that were announced at WWDC and so on and so forth. But also, you know, how to use Keyboard Maestro and some of the Keyboard Maestro macros we were using at the time. You know, that's stuff that you can still go back and listen to, even if you've listened to it before, and, you know, get some useful knowledge out of. And the other thing, of course, that we should mention is Stephen Millard, who's been on the show a few times, has his wonderful automators. I'm blanking on the correct word for it that he used, but he's created automated transcripts of automators episodes and yeah, all of the notes and everything compiled together. So I will make sure to pop a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's the second vault. That's the Obsidian vault of automators podcasts. And he knew when we were shutting down before we announced it, and he's tidying that up. So it's just going to get better, but at some point there's going to be an Obsidian repository that will cover the 5 years of episodes, and you can go back and look into things. In addition, Rose and I are also doing other things. Like I've got a shortcuts field guide that's going to come out probably 3 or 4 weeks after the show shuts down. Talk about bad timing, mm-hmm, right? But either way, you know, it is what it is. And Rose is doing stuff over with iOS Today or iPadOS Today and
iOS Today.
And you've always got stuff you're putting out too. You're making apps. I mean, your company makes automation friendly applications. And so just keep in touch with both of us. If you follow me at maxbarkey.com, where should people look for you, Rose? What's the best website?
At rosemaryorchard.com has got links to, you know, all of the apps and, you know, iOS Today and, you know, all books and so on. And yeah, I will be making sure to update there a little more frequently when I've got a bit more free time to do so. As a listener of Automators, you're probably at least marginally serious about data. So assuming you are interested in data, especially about the ways it continues to shape our world, you need to check out Data Citizens Dialogues, a forward-thinking show brought to you by the folks over at Calibra, the leader in data intelligence. You'll hear firsthand from industry titans, innovators, and executives from some of the world's largest companies as they dive into the hottest topics in data. And you'll get insights into everything from popular staples such as AI governance and data sharing down to new, more nuanced questions, like how do we ensure data readability at a global scale? The most recent episode that I listened to is The Power of a Common Data Language, which talks about how to make sure that everybody in your organization is on the same page and understanding what different kinds of data are. And what I loved about it is the fact that a lot of the topics talked about on this show, and in particular in this episode, are just good practice for any large organization, whether or not it's to do with data. Making sure that everybody's on the same page about keywords and phrases means something, and actually knowing that everyone knows what they're talking about is always a good thing. While data may be shaping our world, Data Systems Dialogues is shaping the conversation. Follow Data Systems Dialogues on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our thanks to Data Systems Dialogues for their support of this show and all of Relay.
Okay, so we heard from Marcus saying you guys talk about a lot of stuff, shortcuts, Apple Script, Keyboard Maestro, and all these other tools. Which one should I start with?
Oh, that's a good question,
Rose. Which one should they start with?
Yeah, so I mean, I would answer that question with another question. What platform are you looking to automate on? And what problem are you trying to solve? So I'd actually answer a question with two questions, because it really does depend. If you're looking to automate something on the Mac, Shortcuts is there. Shortcuts is fine, but it doesn't necessarily have those same integration hooks that it has on iOS. In particular, if you're looking for something that runs automatically at a certain time or when you connect to a certain Wi-Fi network, Shortcuts on macOS can't do that. Not on its own. It needs a helper to help run that, you know, for example, Keyboard Maestro and so on. So if you're looking to, you know, automate things on the Mac, then, and you want automated triggers, then I would suggest probably Keyboard Maestro. If you're looking to automate something that might be iOS or macOS, definitely Shortcuts. If you're looking for something on iOS, I'm probably going to recommend Shortcuts. You know, you can branch out with Scriptable and so on to do things with JavaScript. If you're looking to automate something text-based, Drafts or BBEdit would be my weapons of choice. Probably Drafts more so just because there's a whole bunch of actions in the action repository that you can download and install without having to write any code yourself. But yeah, I mean, it really depends on what solution is it that you, or what problem is it you're solving, and what platform are you trying to solve it on? What about you, David?
Yeah, I think you're right on there. I would just start with the statement that don't learn to automate in a vacuum. Like, if you want to learn to automate, find a problem to solve and then use the learning process to solve that problem, and understand it's going to take longer than expected the first few times. But like Rose said, the problem that you're trying to solve will dictate the tool that you're trying to use. And I think if you've listened to the show, you've got a pretty good idea what they are. Like, another one I would add to Rose's list is if you have file-based automation, like you just want to deal with files, look at Hazel. They just came out with a new version. There's a lot of different tools out there that solve different problems. But the language of automation is common to all the tools. I mean, usually there's a trigger and there's an action. So what are you going to have trigger the automation, whether it's you pressing a key or a clock hitting a certain time of day or your Wi-Fi connecting to a certain network or whatever it is? So that's your trigger. And then what is it going to run off and do? And separate those in your brain and just figure out, you know, the action set that you want and the tool that does that, and then find a way to hook it to a trigger. And if you solve a couple different problems, you may learn a couple different tools, and before you know it, you're an automator. So it's not that bad, but if you attach it to solving a problem, I feel like it's a lot easier.
Yes. Yeah. I think the other thing is we should probably give some general advice for people who are looking to, you know, start automating things and solve automation problems. And I would really recommend, you know, take a step back and look at what it is you want to automate and break it down into chunks and pick one of those chunks and start with that. If you get stuck, pause, go look at another chunk and try that. Then once you've got like two or three chunks and you can sort of bounce between them, I wouldn't recommend having any more than that until you've actually solved one of them. But the chances are, if you break it down in small enough steps, you will find something that somebody else has done out there that's similar that can help solve that problem. So if you've got an automation, you want an automation that whenever you download your electricity bill, it renames it, moves it into a particular folder, and adds a task to OmniFocus or whatever your task manager of choice is to say, pay the bill. Okay, well, that's great. That's a really good thing. But I would start with, okay, well, downloading the electricity bill, like, let's leave that as manual, because scripting, logging into websites to download files and so on, it can be done. I'm not going to recommend doing it just because, like, it's going to get finicky at some point and things are going to get broken because you'll have to, you know, click at the image with Keyboard Maestro or script the browser, and that's a lot of work. So start with the file downloads. Well, that's something you can solve with Hazel. Hazel can watch your downloads folder and it can grab the file. And so the next piece of the puzzle is, you know, when renaming it, right? Renaming it and moving it. Well, those are two actions in Hazel. And so you can start with the renaming part. And if you can't get that to work, then you pause and you do the moving part. And then there's the final part of adding a task to your task manager. Well, maybe to start with, the task that you add to your task manager is really simple. It's just pay electricity bill. It doesn't have any other information than that. And then maybe you make it a little more advanced and you say pay electricity bill and you use the name of the file and you add the path to the file. So, you know, where to find the file on your hard drive, on your computer to the note of the task. And then at some point, maybe you can add, hey, pay electricity bill $237 or whatever it is. I don't know how much electricity bill is in the US, but you know, you can make it more complicated as you go, but keep it simple to start with and then work upwards.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. And like I said, solve a problem. Emily wrote in, she says, sometimes I listen to the show. It sounds like you're frustrated with shortcuts. Does that come through? I guess it does. but she says, you know, what would you fix? You know, what's the problem? And I think what she's asking, I'm going to put my spin on it. It's like, all right, Rose, Tim Cook's going to call you up today and say, Rose, I just listened to the automators. You're so smart about this stuff. I'm going to put you in charge of the shortcuts team. Resources are unlimited. All right, Rose, what are you going to go do when you show up your first day to take over?
Okay. Well, first thing is, I don't want to be the head of shortcuts. So I'm going to say, hey, can we please keep Michael Gorbach, who is the head of the shortcuts team and at the moment. And I feel like he's actually doing a really good job. But what I would like to do to start with actually is to have a team that actually understands and knows shortcuts processing the shortcuts feedback that they receive. Because I am very aware that I've filed feedback that has gone into a black hole because the people processing it did not realize that the words that I used to describe this problem are the words that somebody else are essentially the same as the words somebody else has used to describe a different problem. So there is a particularly horrible bug where if two different applications have a shortcut action with the same name, those actions can occasionally get swapped. And so this means that, you know, if for whatever reason there is an app with the action run shortcut, which Pushcut, for example, had, then that could get swapped with the shortcut's native run shortcut action. And that caused havoc with my automations until I realized what the problem was. Fortunately, it didn't take us that long to figure it out. And then we renamed the Pushcut shortcuts action because I figured out what was happening and that those were randomly getting swapped. And that bug is the first place I would start. And then from there, you know, I would, you know, take a look at the automation triggers and can we bring those to macOS? Can we bring any automation triggers to macOS? Can we make Safari a bit more scriptable? And, you know, those parts of it, you know, mail on macOS doesn't have the same things that mail on iOS has. And I understand they're two different applications, but can we add somebody to the mail team that understands shortcuts and can learn how mail works and can bring everything together for that? I think that is really where I would be starting.
Yeah, that's my starting point too. It's the interoperability of shortcuts between platforms because the Mac feels like a very different place for shortcuts than iPhone and iPad. I mean, that's frankly why I have two different field guides because they're just different. They don't work the same. And it's very easy for people who are trying to get into this to get confused because you make it and it works on the phone, but then it doesn't work on the Mac and vice versa. And I feel like they should intervene for you. Like when you have an action that doesn't work on the Mac, maybe they have some alternative that can run or, you know, and, you know, savvy shortcuts users that know of the problem and know their options often put in platform checks in the shortcut. Like if I'm on Mac, do this, if I'm on iPhone, do this, but that's very tedious and you'd have to know that. And for a lot of people learning shortcuts, they don't. And so it just breaks for them and they're not even sure why. And then they give up on shortcuts. So I feel like if I was in charge, I would put a lot of effort into kind of getting that fixed. So, you know, in a year, like in a year from now, we could say, okay, you're never going to have that problem again. If you try to call an action that doesn't work on your platform, it's going to give you a message explaining, or it's going to do something else instead that it thinks makes sense, but it's just going to, it's going to solve it for you and not just not work and not give you any feedback. And yes. The other thing I think I would do is I think I would make the documentation better and more interactive, because I think a lot of people come into Shortcuts are not programmers. You know, there are a lot of people who are just learning this stuff, and you know, the documentation on individual actions, I think, is too sparse. It doesn't explain it enough. And I can figure it out because I've been doing it a long time, but people new to it don't know what the heck any of those terms mean. And I think they should write better documentation for non-programming humans into Shortcuts. So those are the two things I'd probably work on. But I agree with you. I think they're doing a great job. They've got a lot. You know, they bit off a lot bringing Shortcuts and now putting it on platforms. And I think overall they're doing good work. But those things, like Rose was talking about the Safari, how the Safari actions don't work on Mac drives me nuts. But that's kind of part of the interoperability of platforms. You just kind of make that stuff work. And I'm sure it's written down somewhere on a whiteboard in Cupertino. And it's really easy for you to say on a podcast, yeah, just fix it. But yeah, that would be the thing I would make a priority.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, in particular for the Apple actions. You know, I would love to see this also happen for, you know, other app actions where you've got an app that you can only install on iPhone. And, you know, so you try to run the shortcut on iPad and it doesn't work. And you try to run it on your Mac and it really doesn't work. But the Apple actions in particular, those ones not being the same across platforms, that's also just something that is a really, you know, it's a big downer for somebody when they try to follow a Shortcuts tutorial, but they're on their Mac and they don't necessarily know what they're doing yet. So they're like, okay, well, if I'm on my Mac, it's easy because I can have the two screens open. So, you know, they look at one and they look at the other and they're going, this action doesn't exist. And I can't find it. And also the fact that the search for in Shortcuts for actions works differently on macOS to iOS drives me crazy. On iOS, if you type the name of an app and you search and then you click on the app, it resets your search basically and it shows you all the actions from that app. On macOS, if you type the name of an app, it filters the app list. And then you click on the app, it only shows you the actions for that app that match the search results. And if you click on the little X in the search bar to like remove your search parameter, it unselects the application that you've chosen, which drives me insane every single time I try to use it on macOS, because I'm there going like, I know that I'm looking for an action from this app and it's near the bottom of the list. So I've searched for it and I've clicked on it and now I can't see the action. And so if I click on the cross, I then have to scroll all the way down the app list again. And that just drives me bonkers. And I understand this is, you know, a difference between how things work on macOS and iOS, but I feel like they could have made this one a little bit more friendly.
You know, it's I'm coming up with more too as we talk about this, because I think that they really, what they need are like kind of Shortcuts ambassadors and developer enthusiast people, or I don't know what you call them, developer relations maybe, but they should have really knowledgeable Shortcuts people that can go to the internal Apple teams. Like, there's really no excuse for all the Apple apps not to have really robust Shortcuts support. Like, they should have somebody on the inside going to those teams so they can say, okay, I'm a Shortcuts expert. You're a Safari expert. You know, let's take 2 weeks and just really get this nailed down. And they should also do that externally. There should be resources available if you're an app developer and say, well, I'd like to have Shortcuts support, but I'm not sure what the best way to do it or what would be most useful to the users. And Apple should say, well, certainly you call this person and they'll get on the phone with you and talk you through it and give you some sample code and blah, 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 you know, and maybe they're doing that, but it feels like if they are, they're not doing enough of it.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of developers talk about, you know, how tricky it is. And they've also been burned by, you know, creating Shortcuts actions that work as one kind of app intent and, or, you know, as this kind of shortcut. And then it you know, they had to transition to that kind of shortcut and then they have to transition again. And, you know, that it's understandable that they're a little, you know, hesitant to, you know, immediately hop onto the new thing. But at the same time, you know, Apple is doing their best to try and make it easier. And the new kinds of shortcuts actions that the app intends are, you know, pretty nice. And I'm really glad to see, to be honest, that they are a chunk of the backbone for Apple Intelligence, you know, providing the information and so on that's needed. And, you know, hopefully we'll see all of this tie in together at some point in the not too distant future. But at the moment it is, you know, still a little painful and thorny for users who don't necessarily, you know, realize or know all of the things that they would be expected to know. I got bit the other day, David. I created a shortcut on my phone, tried to run it on my iPad, and it crashed. And I was there going, what the heck is the problem with this? Turns out I forgot to download the app on my iPad. Okay. That was it. Once I downloaded the app on my iPad, everything was fine.
Yeah.
But it would be really nice if shortcuts could see, hey, so this action in this shortcut is using, you know, it is not installed, but can be installed. And if it, when I tried to run it, would say, hey, this app is like XYZ app is required and not installed. Would you like to download it? Yes. Yeah. Because that also would then go great, you know, for when I share a shortcut with you. If you don't have one of the apps installed that the shortcut uses, you don't just get unknown action. Like you could see a little placeholder for it if you open the shortcut to edit it. And when you try to run it, then it would try to it would prompt you to download the app from the App Store. That would be really nice. But yeah, it doesn't quite do that yet. So fingers crossed, some of these pain points will get cleaned up at some point in the future. And I know the shortcuts team are working really hard on it. And I know, you know, the teams at Apple, sometimes I'm pretty certain that Journal is just like one person working on it, like maybe a couple. But I don't think it's a team, really. I think it's a few people, a bit like the graphing calculator was when they broke in to build the graphing calculator for the Mac. But, you know, the Journal app is pretty awesome. But I can't blame, you know, the few developers working on it for not having great shortcut support yet, because they have to work on the whole Journal app, which keeps being headlined at WWDC, and they've got limited resources. So, you know, I to be clear, I don't know how many people are on the Journal team at Apple, but my suspicion is that it's very few. And so it would be nice if there could be some extra support within Apple for all of those things.
Yeah. And it is a $1 trillion company. Like they could bring on a few more people to do this. John writes, yes, in, sorry to see the automators go. Is there ever any automations that you've given up on? All right. That's a good question, John, straight to the heart. You know, where have we failed as automators? I'll go first on this one. I often struggle with web-based automation stuff, like, you know, the classic go and download my credit card statement every month and, you know, OCR the PDF and put it in a specific folder and all that stuff. I find web services very inconsistent. And some companies I do this with and it works like a charm, and other companies, for whatever reason, the way they've coded their website, it hardly ever works. And it just makes me nuts. And when I hit those ones where I feel like I have to debug it every month, I just stop doing it. So that is an example of an automation I've given up on. Anything that requires constant fiddling as an automation to me is a failed automation. It needs to be consistent. I shouldn't have to rewrite it every month. And that's a good example for me. How about you, Rose? Do you have any automations you've ever given up on? Maybe you don't.
I mean, it's one of those things where usually the approach that I'll take, if I can't solve the automation problem, which I frequently cannot because there are things outside of my control, as much as I would like to pretend that I can control everything, I absolutely cannot. But whenever I run into something that I absolutely can't automate for whatever reason, I'll still see if I can automate a bit of it. You know, I can't automate everything. Like, I cannot automate physically replacing the batteries in my smart door locks. That is not something I am able to do. But I can absolutely have myself send a push notification every hour when I'm at home and I'm not asleep, reminding me to go and change those battery door locks when they run low. because that is something that is pretty freaking important, that if I don't do that, then I could well get locked out of my house. Don't worry, folks. I do have the backup battery. I've got one backup battery in my car, and I've got another one stored with a friendly neighbor, which seems like a good idea because it's a 9-volt battery to work as a spare if needed. But that you can connect from the outside. There's sort of two pins that you can, you know, hold the battery onto to still make the smart lock work. But, you know, I cannot automate replacing those batteries. Like, I could probably build a robot that has AA batteries in it that then when it gets a notification to say that the battery is low, knows which lock to go to. That would be a huge problem to figure out. Unscrews the cover. Again, big problem to figure out. Takes out the other batteries, puts them somewhere to go to the battery recycling place, and then inserts new batteries. But this seems like a whole lot of big problem, and I can't do that. Sometimes it's not worth solving problems. Sometimes it's also worth considering solving problems the other way. Another way, I had an issue with my robot vacuum recently where it doesn't automatically change daylight savings. I don't quite understand why it can't automatically change daylight savings, but that means that whenever the clocks change twice a year, the automations run at the wrong time. I recently solved this problem, not by logging in and automatically changing the time zone on it or doing anything like that. I took the automation out of their app and I did it in Home Assistant, which does automatically change the time. So sometimes solving the problem differently is the right solution to the problem, or avoiding the problem. But yeah, there are some things that I've given up on for sure, like automatically changing those batteries. That's not going to happen. I'm just not going to do it. I will absolutely notify myself to death until I finally actually go and change the battery.
I absolutely love, though, that you considered maybe I could build a robot that would do it for me.
I know that it is technically possible to build a robot to replace these batteries. Like, I am 100% aware that this is a possibility, but it's going to take a lot of work. Like, I'm going to have to do a whole bunch of different models for the 3D printer. I'm going to have to buy mechanical parts. I'm going to have to program it, and I'm going to have to think of like a brain to run it on. And this gets into the realm of I'm spending a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort to automate something that really only needs doing every 6 to 9 months. And it takes me 2 minutes. And one of the things that I've also done to automate solving this problem is I've put a screwdriver in my battery bag. So I have a zipped bag that contains all the batteries that I need for smart home stuff, which is labeled, like there are bags inside of that which are labeled CR2032 and, you know, AA, AAA, etc. I've just put a screwdriver in that bag. And then I don't even, like, once I grab the battery bag, I don't need to go find a screwdriver or anything. I just grab the battery bag, unscrew the thing, put some new batteries in, drop the other batteries into the little pot by the television, which is where the recycled battery or batteries to recycle go, and done. That's it. Simple. I was curious from a technical perspective as to whether or not I could build a robot, and I realized very quickly that it was very technically possible, but also, like, it's just not a good idea, because what happens if, like, I move the robot and then it has to figure out, like, where to go to now? But, like, I've put a new piece of furniture in the way because it only needs to run every 6 to 9 months. And, like, the two door locks in my living room are at the same height, but the door lock at my front door is at a completely different height. And so it would need to be able to go up and down. And sometimes there's laundry drying in the hallway, so that would get in its way. And, yeah, it gets messy quickly. And that just, yeah, seemed like a bad idea. A fun theoretical exercise, but not a good practical exercise to automate.
I find the fact that you've got, like, the screwdriver with the batteries very satisfying. I do the same thing, like, and having labels on them. Maybe this is a common thing to automators, that we just like to have our stuff organized and everything where it belongs. This episode of The Automators is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. Find the qualified candidates you want to talk to faster. Post your job for free today. Just go to linkedin.com/automators. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. It's important when you're hiring that you get the right people with the right skills and the right attitudes and mindsets. Building a great team is difficult, but LinkedIn Jobs makes it a lot easier. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn also knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats and might not have the time or resources to hire. That's why they're constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions and making the process even easier and quicker. It's easy to see why 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/automators. That's, once again, linkedin.com/automators to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Go check it out at linkedin.com/automators, and thank you, LinkedIn, for all of your support of the Automators podcast. Rose, last segment of the Automators, let's talk about the future of automation. I thought we'd break it down by platform, starting with the Mac. You and I are both lovers of using the Apple Macintosh. And it's come out on this show, but I feel like we're kind of in a really, I'm calling it a golden age. Maybe it's just a preview of what's to come. But over the run of this show, not only did we get more automation tools like shortcuts for the Mac, they all started talking to each other. So these days it is so easy to put together automations that do diverse and different things using the various tools. You know, getting back to my tool belt analogy. But I feel like the Mac is in great shape for automation these days. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's just choices, like all of the choices. And I love that. I really do, because it means that I don't necessarily have to use Hazel to solve my automated files problems. I could use Cubo Maestro. The answer to it, the question of which do I use, is both, because it depends on what I want to do with the file once it's been added there. But the fact that there's just so much choice, and, you know, the Apple script still there, doesn't seem to be going away. It's still able to be added to applications now and so on. And the fact that shortcuts automations are there as well, and that a lot of these tools, you know, Better Touch Tool, Cubo Maestro, Hazel, etc., they're all adding support for each other, or they're able to support each other through AppleScript or URL schemes and so on. It means that there's just a huge wealth of interconnected possibilities, which means that whatever you start by learning on the Mac, unless you start with automated workflows, which, you know, Apple did make a point of saying they will be going away and will be being converted into shortcuts at some point, I feel like whatever you start with, you'll be able to, you know, dive in and really, you know, use whatever and then build on that with other tools as necessary and as you would like.
What about mobile, iPhone, iPad, just smartphones in general? Where do you see the current state of automation, and where do you see it going?
I mean, current state is pretty good. You know, for all our griping about shortcuts earlier, you know, it's getting better every year. They're adding more support for things and they're listening. So that, remember when we first got shortcuts automations, and one of the actions that we had at the time was change watch face. We still have the action to change watch face. But the fact that you could then have a focus mode turning on trigger, changing a watch face, and then the next year, they didn't Sherlock it. They didn't stop you being able to do it via shortcuts actions. But they listened and they said, oh, this is a really cool part of focus modes. Like, we should add this to focus modes as a filter. And then that has expanded. So we've got more focus mode filters. So when I'm working, I can have my drafts workspace automatically set to my working workspace, and so on and so forth. And I feel like that's just a really nice, fun thing that has got better. And from the fact that they've been listening to us, and more apps are adding support for these things as well, which is just really nice that this is a thing that has happened and has got better. And I also feel like with, you know, Apple Intelligence and App Intents really being the backbone of it, we've got more to see from shortcuts in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, mobile is not as robust as the Mac. There's, you know, we don't have Apple events, and I will forever regret that they didn't think about putting something like that technology in the early days of the of iOS. And I think it's probably too late to do it now. But we've come a long way in automation on mobile. And they're addressing automation differently than they do on the Mac, because I think phone users are not going to want to write an Apple script. You know, it just doesn't even really make sense. So I think it's in a lot better shape than it was. And I do think the future is interesting. And we're going to talk about this in Automators Max, but just the idea of the app intents, that that's the common language between automation and shortcuts actions and Apple intelligence. You know, I think there's going to be interesting developments of that in the future. What about web automation? We've talked about this off and on the show, but there are websites out there that kind of use web-based automation to glue together web services, and they've grown throughout the run of the show. I mean, there's more now than there were, and they're more powerful than they used to be. Where do you see the state of that?
Well, that's a good question. And honestly, I think it's just going to get bigger. I think we're going to see more places realizing that building everything themselves is a chunk of work, and having their own integrations with every, in particular, social media platform under the sun. We saw this when Twitter suddenly started locking its API down and saying, nah, not you, not you, not you. All of those like ticket systems and things like that that had integrations with Twitter, and all of these platforms that had, I use Twitter to do this thing, suddenly couldn't anymore. And this was also a big problem for a lot of the users where, now because Twitter has blocked a bunch of stuff like that, you've got a lot of companies that are on Threads. And then in some places, you've got loads of people on Blue Sky. In other cases, you've got loads of people on Mastodon. Well, adding support for all three of those to any system, that's a lot of work. But if you can farm that out to, say, Zapier or Make or if this and that, and they can add the support, then that also means that, you as the user who wants to connect that to your ticket system so that when somebody posts at you on Mastodon or they send a thread on Blue Sky or Threads tagging you, then you can have that funnel into, an automated system. You can create one automation, duplicate it, and just change the trigger. Or you could even add multiple triggers to the same automation and have them, all flow through the same way. And I think that that is something that, is a nice possibility. And now I'm not saying, of course, that, these platforms shouldn't build their own integrations with, whatever it is that they want to do things with, It's one of those things where, you get what you pay for. And if you're relying on a third-party service to do your work for you, you're not necessarily going to get the best results. But at the same time, for a really small company that wants to just build something, it's going to get better. And we've already seen things like GoodLinks, a really great little application that I use all the time for storing the things that I would like to read later. And it automatically downloads the articles as well. This is not necessarily web automation per se, but it's got browser plugins for multiple browsers, not just Safari, but it's also got Firefox and Chrome plugins. And the fact that that's a thing that an app developer can do and have that, have the data still stored in CloudKit and synced using Apple servers between the devices is pretty cool. So I think we're going to see a lot more from these. And I suspect Zapier, if this and that, and Make aren't going to be going anywhere anytime soon, but we may see some alternatives to them pop up. What do you think?
I'm with you. I think that web services are going to become increasingly important. I mean, they've emerged over the last 5 years as a real force. I mean, back in the old days, the platform wars between Mac and Windows, well, that all became irrelevant when so many of our tools are now web-based. And I feel like the needs of AI servers and things that are kind of now emerging are going to make that even more so. These things are going to be even more useful. And the beauty of it is if you learn automation, even in just like shortcuts, the same sorts of language and ideas transfer over to these web services. So it's not that hard to jump over to the web automation. What do you think of Apple's commitment to automation as we sit here and going forward?
It's one of those things where they don't necessarily talk about it as, a big thing. They're not continually saying like, oh yeah, we're committed to automation. We want to, be automating things all the time. But the fact that they're talking about Apple Intelligence and so on, and, you know, they've made App Intent such a big backbone for that, you know, I think it is pretty important to them. So I think we're going to see more and more coming from this. And I think it might even be a little, you know, sneaky in some ways. And I'm not saying that as a bad thing, but I am saying that as a good thing, where, you know, if they, you know, as they've added these things, you know, they're making it more and more possible for people to automate things without really thinking about automation. You know, my mom and my dad don't think about changing their watch faces as an automation. It's just something that happens based on the focus mode that they've selected on their phone, and they went in and set it up, and it's not automation to them. It's just a thing. So yeah, I think it's something that's going to improve for sure as time goes on.
Yeah. And I do think automation will take on different forms as we go into the future and the technology gets more powerful. But I think historically, Apple was not particularly interested in automation. I mean, the old days they were, like back in the early days of the Mac when they had the tie-in with the publishing, it was such a big part of their business. I think they lost interest in it for a while. And for whatever reason, that was reignited with the purchase of Workflow. And I think there, especially the Shortcuts team, I think there are people at Apple that are 100% dedicated to automation. But if I were to handicap it from the outside, not knowing any interior stuff, but I feel like the real commitment at Apple right now is Apple Intelligence. And but automation and Shortcuts gets to surf the wake of that because of the common intents language and stuff. So I think automation is going to be a big beneficiary of what they're focused on right now, even if it isn't the big focus, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that is the thing, you know, it's a little bit of a Trojan horse, but not in a bad way, in a pretty good way. So I think that's pretty cool for how it's all going to work.
The last question I have, the last kind of navel gazing question, is the focus of automation so often is like company wide. Like if you talk to people who do IT, they do all sorts of automation to set up new computers and all sorts of cool stuff that they need to do every day. And they make their lives much easier through automation. I think if you look into automation and learning it so often, it's this big like enterprise style automation that is the focus of products. Our goal on this show has always been not that, but user automation, like people who just using their computers to get their work done, that want to be able to make it go a little faster, a little more efficient. Where do you see the future of user-based automation? I think we're in good shape. In fact, I'll go first here. I think we're in great shape. Yeah. I think that, like I was talking about, this golden age on the Mac and the increasing on-ramp to automation that we're getting, like, you know, even just like the Shortcuts gallery is so useful for people who don't even know how to do a shortcut. They can download and use something immediately. And I'd like to think that people are going to become more curious about this as the tools get easier. So I feel like user-focused automation, which is the stuff that you're doing if you're listening to this show, is only going to get more popular over time.
Yeah, I think I have to agree where, you know, it's something that, it's not necessarily a big, you know, thing that people are going to be thinking about at the forefront of their minds. But especially with AI becoming a much bigger thing, people are starting to realize that, you know, they can't necessarily just sit there and, you know, rearrange data and spreadsheets every day. Maybe they should figure out a way of scripting rearranging the data in the spreadsheets or filtering the data in the spreadsheets and skilling up. And automation is a big part of that. Whether or not people are ready to admit it and give it that name is an entirely separate point. I think a lot of people don't necessarily want to think about automation because they think it means that jobs are going away. I personally see that it's a way of creating new jobs, and it doesn't mean that the old ways are going to go away anytime soon. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, I think we're going to see more and more automation come into play, in particular when people start getting nervous about AI taking their jobs. They're going to find ways to make themselves better, and writing scripts and automations that they know how to run and that they've set up and configured to meet business needs is or personal needs is going to be really useful. I also think we're going to see a lot more personal automation stuff in the smart home sphere as well, because it is an accessibility feature. You know, not having to get up and go over to the door to press the button on the light switch to turn off, press the light switch to turn off the light is something that is a thing that is needed by a large chunk of the population. And it's, you know, nice that we have this possibility and it's becoming more and more accessible to everybody, and that it's becoming more affordable and easier to configure and set up. And I think that that's very cool. And I'm hoping we're going to see more of this.
Well, you know what I do know? I want to thank all of the listeners of the show. This is the final episode. We had a crazy idea. What was it? 5-6 years ago. Let's make a show just about automation. Mm-hmm. And you guys came along with us on this wonderful ride. And we've got so much great feedback and ideas from you and interacting with you over the years. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. Rose and I love making this show. Don't get us wrong. We loved it, but it's just, we're both super busy, and to make it right, frankly, because we love it is why we're shutting it down. I want to thank our sponsors today, Notion, LinkedIn Talent, Data Citizens. Everybody, keep automating. We talked in the show about places you can go to keep following us and continue your automation journey. Please do that. And signing off for the last time, thanks for listening.
Goodbye, everybody.